Sparta, Athens' neighbor, was a horse of a different color. Society in Sparta was organized around the concept of cradle-to-grave formal training. The whole state was a universal schoolhouse. Official prescriptions for the population filled every waking minute, and the family was employed as a convenience for the state. Sparta's public political arrangements were an elaborate sham, organized nominally around an executive branch with two legislative bodies, but ultimate decision-making was in the hands of ephors, a small elite who conducted state policy among themselves. The practical aspect of imitation democracy figures strongly in the thought of later social thinkers such as Machiavelli and Hobbes, as well as in minds near our own time who had influence on the shape of American forced schooling. Spartan ideas of management came into American consciousness through classical studies in early schooling, through churches, and also through interest in the German military state of Prussia, which consciously modeled itself after Sparta. As the 19th century entered its final decades, American university training came to follow the Prussian Spartan model. Service to business and the political state became the most important reason for college and university existence after 1910. No longer was college primarily about developing mind and character in the young. Instead, it was about molding those things as instruments for use by others. Here is an important clue to the philosophical split which informed the foundation of modern schooling, and to an important extent still does. Small farmers, craftsfolk, tradespeople, little town and city professionals, little industrialists, and older manorial interests took a part of their dreams of America from democratic Athens or from republican Rome, not the Rome of the emperors. This comprised a significant portion of ordinary America. But new urban managerial elites pointed to a future based on Spartan outlook. When the instructional system of Athens transferred to imperial Rome, a few schools we would recognize began to appear. The familiar punishment practices of colonial America can be found anticipated vividly in the famous fresco at Herculaneum, showing a Roman schoolboy being held by two of his classmates while the master advances carrying a long whip. Roman schools must have started discipline early in the morning, for we find the poet Martial cursing a school for waking him up at cock's crow with shouts and beatings. Horace immortalizes pedagogue Orbilius for whipping a love of old poets into him. But we shouldn't be misled by these school references. What few schools there were in Rome were for boys of prosperous classes, and even most of those relied upon tutors, tradition, and emulation, not school. The word pedagogue is Latin for a specialized class of slave assigned to walk a student to the schoolmaster. Over time, the slave was given additional duties. His role was enlarged to that of drill master, a procedure memorialized in Varro's Instituit Pedagogus Docet Magister. In my rusty altar boy Latin, the master creates instructions, the slave pounds it in. A key to modern schooling is this: free men were never pedagogues. And yet, we refer to the science of modern schooling as pedagogy. The unenlightened parent who innocently brings matters of concern to the pedagogue, whether that poor soul is called schoolteacher, principal, or superintendent, is usually beginning a game of frustration which will end in no fundamental change. A case of barking up the wrong tree in a dark wood, where the right tree is far away and obscure. Pedagogy is social technology for winning attention and cooperation or obedience, while strings are attached to the mind and placed in the hands of an unseen master. This may be done holistically, with smiles, music, and light-duty simulations of intellection, or it can be done harshly, with rigorous drills and competitive tests. The quality of self-doubt aimed for, in either case, is similar. Pedagogy is a useful concept to help us unthread some of the mysteries of modern schooling. That it is increasingly vital to the social order is evinced by the quiet teacher pay revolution that has occurred since the 1960s. As with police work, to which pedagogy bears important similarities, school pay has become relatively good. Its hours of labor short, its job security first rate. Contrast this with the golden years of one-room schooling where the pay was subsistence only and teachers were compelled to board around to keep body and soul together. Yet there was no shortage then of applicants, and many sons of prominent Americans began their adult lives as school teachers. With the relative opulence of today, it would be simple to fill teaching slots with accomplished men and women if that were a goal. A little adjustment in what are rationally indefensible licensing requirements would make talented people, many performance-tested adults in their 50s and 60s, available to teach. That there is not such fluid access is a good sign the purpose of schooling is more than it appears. The year-in, year-out consistency of mediocre teacher candidates demonstrates clearly that the school institution actively seeks, nurtures, hires, and promotes the caliber of personnel it needs.